You're tuned into The Wire, 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa, ko Mary Margaret Slack tōku, ingoa, no mai haere mai ki te wire mō tēnei rā. Kia ora everyone and welcome to The Wire for Ratu, Tuesday the 18th of December. What?
I know.
What? December just went by like that. You know how Apple has those things now where it shows the date of your photos? I swear I went to the beach with my friend the other day and then I was looking at the photo of it and it was over a month ago now.
That's crazy.
I just don't understand it. but welcome everyone. Hi. Welcome to the Tuesday Wire, the final Tuesday Wire for the year and my final Wire for quite a while for the first half of 2019.
Yeah,
I will
very
be
sad.
In absentia. I'm going to miss it a lot as well. But so it's very bittersweet. But I am very excited for our last show today. We're going to be looking back on some of the most important and interesting things that happened on the Tuesday Wire this year. And of course, if you've heard behind me, I've got my happy helpers, my Christmas elves, as I like to call them, with me. We've got Justin, Ben, and Ella here.
You've never called us that before.
Today I want you to be that. I just feel like everything was a little bit jolly in the newsroom today.
Yes, it's very jolly.
It's slightly above average time of year. Anyway, coming up on the show today, we look back on political commentator Tracy Barnett's comments on Dr. Christine Blasey Ford's testimony against now Supreme Court Judge Brett Kavanaugh. Ben will share developments on parliamentary reviews of New Zealand abortion law and what the nurses' organisation told him earlier this year when the alternative models were first put forward. Three of them, eh?
Yeah.
Right. More to come on that. On the Green Desk this week, Ella talks to psychologist David Menkes about the effects of climate change on mental health.
That's right.
It's an interesting angle, eh?
It is.
Is it predominantly focused on like climate change refugees? Or?
No, it's actually focused on people in this country or, I suppose, first world countries.
Right.
Yeah.
The West.
The West.
I then take us back to our Worry Week on cultural appropriation when I spoke to an anthropology lecturer from Auckland Uni about the modernization of carver. And finally, Justin does have a more recent international story about Thailand.
Yes, they're having an election 4 years after a coup in 2014, but I'll be covering more about that.
Awesome. As always, hea ha ofukado, please get in touch with us with any thoughts that you have. I would love to hear from you. Tukupatuhi mai, text us on 5395 or why am I? Give us a call on 309-3879.
Irirangi Poho, Radio Bosom.
The Wire.
At the time that Christine Blasey Ford had just delivered her testimony against Brett Kavanaugh, we spoke to political commentator Tracy Barnett. She began by analysing Kavanaugh's behaviour during his own testimony. Now, please be aware, sexual assault is a key focus of this discussion, and although attacks are not detailed, distressing language is called into question.
Most disturbingly, when he was questioned about the smallest details of things like his high school yearbook and things he had written in it, he referred it to obscuring, if not downright questionable, lies in his answers. And here's some examples. One senator asked him, what does it mean by referring to a devil's triangle, which is a sexual threesome between two men and a woman? And he said that it was a drinking game. He referred to being a Renata alumni. He and other friends had referred to that in his yearbooks. And he said that that didn't refer to having sexual conquests with this woman, but it just showed that she was one of us. He was asked about the phrase boofed, a term that refers to anal sex, and he said, hey, we were 16, it refers to flatulence. There's a term that was called FFFF, 4th of July, and he said that it didn't refer to what your listeners, forgive me, this might be triggering to some listeners who might be listening in who have experienced sexual assault. It was referring to find them, French them, finger them. You can imagine what the next F is, and then forget them. Right. And he said, in fact, he explained it as this was stuttering before a word that a friend used to use before he used the F word. We saw also when a female senator asked if he ever blacked out from drinking, he replied, have you? And then later after a break, and obviously after advice from counsel, he came back and he apologized to her. But what was really disturbing was that he referred to this as a revenge from the Clintons. And what we saw was a man who didn't comport in the way that we have always saw our Supreme Court justices to be, boring, neutral or give a semblance of stability and neutrality. Here was a man who looked like he had a political grudge on his shoulder, and he was going to wear it in front of the entire nation, and he didn't stop.
Yeah.
Lindsey Graham entered in, and in spluttering, in a fit of rage, he pointed at the rest of the committee and said, "This man has nothing to apologize for. I hope the American people can see through this sham. And if you vote no, you're legitimizing the most despicable thing I've ever seen in my time in politics." Suddenly, all the other senators who had been silent up until this time came toward Judge Kavanaugh's defense and piled on with their indignation as well.
And it's scary because we have to remind ourselves that this is someone's trauma being dismissed carelessly.
Absolutely. And I think what happened is it weighed heavily, even on some of the Republicans on the committee. And so the drama keeps going.
Yeah.
There's one Republican senator, a guy named Jeff Flake. He does not have to face, he's retiring, so he doesn't have to face a voting public again. And he was really troubled by what he heard, so much so that senators started to physically even surround him, literally arguing that he should vote yes on Kavanaugh's nomination. And reluctantly, badgered, he finally agreed. And just as he left the committee room and he was going up to an elevator, there were female protesters in the hallway, and they literally stuck their hand in the door of the elevator so it wouldn't close. And one of them began to cry, and she said, "No one believed me. No one believed my assault. If you approve this man, you're telling me that my assault, my life doesn't matter. Senator, look at me." And she was openly crying. "Tell me if it doesn't matter that you would let people like that go to the highest court in the land." He got back into the committee room and walked from his side of the aisle, tapped the shoulder of a Democratic senator, Jeff Koons. He said, "Look, this is tearing our country apart." And together they came up with a small compromise of sorts, and it's where we are now. Delay this hearing for 1 week and just allow an FBI investigation.
Yeah.
And that's where we are right now.
Referring back to the kind of language that we heard during the hearing, it's why it's so significant that women like Dr. Ford are pressing charges, particularly in cases where the attack occurred in the past, because it shows that nothing is excusable anymore. And I think that for young people, this particular case is pretty momentous because, you know, the Me Too movement has focused on the workplace a lot, but we have a new problem in our high schools because rape culture is more insidious in new ways in environments like high school. So do you agree that initiating a focus on school culture is a necessary component of Me Too? And do you think that this case is sort of a step in that direction?
I think this case will be groundbreaking for generations to come, not just in the U.S., but in other places like New Zealand, because we always thought that what we did in high school, what we did in our past, was in our past. And this is showing that you are a moral being from a very young age, and you are accountable to that.
Irirangi Pōhō, Radio Bosom.
The Wire.
That was political commentator Tracy Barnett, and let's bear in mind that Brett Kavanaugh has since been appointed to the Supreme Court, thus maintaining an extremely high position of power. But on a slightly more positive note, Ben's got a story.
Hi. So if we go back to October, I spoke to Kate Weston from the New Zealand Nurses Organisation, and we talked about the report that had just come back from the Law Commission that recommended abortion be treated as a health issue, not a criminal one. Currently, women need authorization from two doctors if they want to have an abortion, and doctors can flat out refuse to authorize the procedure. The New Zealand Nurses Organisation was part of the Law Commission's wider health sector consultations, and I spoke specifically to Kate about Model A. So, a report's come back from the Law Commission that recommends treating abortion as a health issue and not a criminal one. Currently, women need authorization from two doctors if they want to have an abortion, and doctors can flat out refuse to authorize the procedure. So, the New Zealand Nurses Organisation was part of the Law Commission's wider health sector consultations. This morning I spoke with Kate Weston from the NZNO, and I asked her why Model A, one of three alternative legal models, feels like the best fit.
So that is the model that actually puts the power in the hands of the pregnant woman and her health professional. And that's where we believe that it sits that it's a health decision and that women should be able to discuss freely with their health professional, and that a request to end a pregnancy should not be treated as something that's criminal.
How important is it that New Zealand starts approaching abortion in a more humane and modern way?
It's really critical that women at the moment, particularly women who live rurally, are really disadvantaged by the current system of requiring sign-off by other consultants once you've seen had your initial contact. So if you're living rurally or remotely, that can be a number of weeks. And when we're talking about progression of a pregnancy, that's actually really hard to put women through that when they've already had a really tough decision that they've made.
You've said that nurses sometimes have an ongoing relationship with patients more than they would with consultants. What do these relationships look like?
Well, the relationship with the consultant tends to be sort of a one-off, and it's for a special request or a particular procedure. And generally, nurses particularly have got an ongoing relationship in primary care where they will see the same patients over and over again, and they do establish rapport. And because it's a primary care relationship, you'd expect that people will see you more frequently, whereas a specialist or consultant relationship is more of a, for a specific purpose.
Do you think abortion would be heavily stigmatised if a woman's decision to have an abortion was simply between her and her doctor and not this really convoluted process?
I think also, and not necessarily between a woman and her doctor, between woman and nurse, woman and a midwife, because we're actually aware that a lot of women don't actually see a doctor when they find themselves pregnant at all. They will seek out other health practitioners, and those practitioners may well be a nurse or a midwife.
Going forward, what does the NZNO think needs to happen to help push abortion law reform in the right direction?
We need people to be aware and to be able to talk openly about the issues, and to really consider why a 1961 piece of legislation is really still in place. We want women to be able to have the choice to be able to work directly and talk directly with their health practitioner. And you asked about destigmatising. Where they have made the laws more liberal in other countries, we haven't seen a huge rush of increase of abortions. In fact, the reverse has happened. So women have been able to seek timely health care, and that, you know, that includes being able to talk about their choices around progressing or not with their pregnancy.
How have you found women in terms of discussing abortion? Do you find it's something people really struggle to kind of speak openly about because they don't feel like they can?
It's a sort of tough topic that doesn't tend to come up, you know, sort of in an easy social conversation. Women are still very private. It is a very private, you know, women's fertility and reproduction and all of that spectrum of being pregnant, not being pregnant, having difficulty getting pregnant, all of those sorts of things, miscarriage and actually choosing to terminate a pregnancy, are all things that are subjects that are not really widely and openly discussed. But once somebody opens the door and the discussion starts, it's something that is women actually will talk openly, particularly to each other, about.
What would be your message to MPs that could have the opportunity to do a conscience vote on this issue?
That they consider that what we are asking for, NZNO's position, is we want this to be a health issue, not a crimes issue. And what we are asking for them to consider is that women need to have the opportunity to discuss openly their options with full informed consent with a suitably skilled and qualified health practitioner, and that we look after women's mental and physical health and their reproductive health in general, and give them the opportunity to have a discussion about a health issue and not be criminalised because they're wanting to make a particular decision.
Irirangi Pō, Radio Bosom.
The Wire.
That was Kate Weston speaking to me back in October about Law Commission recommendations around abortion reform. More recently, a group of doctors on moral and religious grounds are saying they're going to fight any inclination they should lose the right to turn patients away who request abortions. The Law Commission's proposal a couple of months ago suggested, quote, these conscientious objectors should have to refer these patients to other doctors who will not be opposed to such a procedure. Opposing doctors don't have to currently recommend a specific alternative facility or doctor to go to. They just have to state to patients they can go elsewhere. This can lead to unnecessary delays, and you really have to wonder whether some women don't go ahead with the procedure because it all becomes rather complicated and awkward. To quote Andrew Little, there have been some cases where a medical practitioner declining to give advice on conscientious objection grounds has said, "And I'm not going to give you any advice on where else you can go." That seems to be wrong. That was Andrew Little.
Wow. Thanks, Ben. Text us on 5395 with your thoughts on those two stories. We'll be right back after some Grimes. You're on 95BFM.
Oh, Check it out, dude. This year I'm doing all my Christmas shopping online.
Hella gnarly.
High five.
Yeah.
Suss this year's Christmas shopping online with Real Groovy Records. An unparalleled range of gifts, plus nationwide free delivery on purchases over $50. Hella gnarly. Real Groovy Records. Corporate free since 81. Go to realgroovy.co.nz.
Remember when your car broke down? It was pouring with rain, the middle of nowhere, and still, Mum drove across town with jumper leads, a thermos, and a kind word.
That deserves a thank you. This Christmas, say thank you with Thank You's beautifully crafted body care.
Made from naturally derived ingredients, Thank You commit 100% of profits to funding water and toilets for people in need.
Good for you, good for humanity.
Make someone smile with a beautiful gift from the Thank You range. Go to thankyou.co.
Wakey, wakey, Auckland, it's breakfast.
This radio station, 95 BFM, to celebrate its 50th year at the Power Station on February the 15th, we will be having a memorable night out, we guarantee it, to celebrate. And we'd love you to come along as well.
Mikey Havoc.
Woo!
Weekday mornings. And a monthly chance to win a year's free broadband.
Good on ya.
Thanks to Orcon. 95 BFM Breakfast with Mikey Havoc. Weekday mornings from 7 till 10.
It's music. 95. The originator. BFM, the original originator. Broadcast to the world and podcast to your device on 95bfm.com.
Kia tau te rangi marie, o rangi nui e tui honei, o papu tuanuku e takatonei, o te tai ao e awhinei I a tātou, tihei Māori ora. This is The Green Desk on 95BFM.
Hello, Ella.
Hi.
Welcome back to The Wire, everyone.
So I got into journalism because I've been studying climate change for years and have gotten pretty frustrated with how stagnant and impersonal the conversation is around this issue. For me personally, I feel a lot of anxiety around climate change because I know how awful it's going to get in my lifetime. I've sworn off having kids because of it. It's super overwhelming to be aware of and to see what pathetic response there's been from governments around the world. I want to make the issue more relatable to people and give people different ways to think and talk about it. This interview with David Menkes, who was a professor of psychological medicine at the University of Auckland, really captured some of the alternative discourses I want to encourage. We discuss the ways climate change and mental health intersect. I think for most people, it's going to be extremely disruptive and unexpected. And it seems that that's going to have an emotional and psychological impact.
Absolutely. Something you may have seen about how the World Health Organization has, you know, stepped up to address this challenge. And so what they say is that climate change will be the defining issue for health systems in the 21st century. I mean, that's it. That's the top of the list. I'd probably put the threat of nuclear war up there somewhere.
Right. Yeah.
But that's on the list. But here it is. Number one, they say, is climate change. And they go on to say that health professionals have the knowledge, cultural authority, and responsibility to protect health from climate change. Big task, and cannot shirk that responsibility. In many cases, we're not going to really be able to prevent it. We're going to have to be talking about damage control and mitigation because it's already happening. There are already people dying. There are already streams of refugees that are set to increase over the coming decade. So we've really got to gear up. And I think, you know, health systems generally, but including mental health, we need to get ready for this. And because, you know, even if we stop burning fossil fuels today, we still have that huge signal that's going to continue to disrupt climate for the next decades. And the problem is, of course, that if we don't slow that ship down and turn it around, it's going to get worse and possibly cataclysmic.
I wonder what your maybe suggestions are, because hearing all of this information is very overwhelming. And I sort of wonder if people aren't as engaged or active around climate change because of that reason?
Absolutely. No, that's certainly true. And you could make the same argument about the risk of nuclear weapons being used, that it's so huge and almost unfathomable what could happen that it's easier just not to think about it. Of course, that's not a very adaptive thing in the long run, and our children and grandchildren will not thank us for it. But we really need to grapple with the reality. And I think, you know, the way to do that is to realize that there is a difference that ordinary people can make. And one of the main things we can do is keep it on the agenda. Keep talking about it as you and I are right now. You know, talk to your neighbors, talk to your friends, and, you know, wherever possible, bring it into the here and now. You know, accordingly, there's all these little decisions that we make about how we manage our day-to-day lives. And it is important, not so much for the absolute contribution it makes to, you know, reducing, in this case, fossil fuel consumption, but also the sort of collective vibe of what we do and how we communicate and how we live. That should be out there. It should be talked about. It should be celebrated. I think that it's just something that needs to be much more visible and part of day-to-day life and conversation.
It seems like there's kind of this strange social silence around climate change when I bring it up often, and it feels like conversations don't go very far because people are kind of like, oh, yeah, that sucks. Yeah, it's terrible. And that's kind of it.
Yeah, and part of that surely comes from the sense that, oh, well, we can't do anything about it, and, you know, the world is screwed, and to hell, might as well just enjoy, you know, what we can while it's here kind of thing. Ultimately, you got to understand that there's a lot of people who think that way, and that we've got to manage that sort of disconnection from reality. I think they outnumber the deniers, actually, the apathetic middle who probably would accept the scientific evidence and probably agree, if they bothered to think about it or talk about it, that, yeah, well, this is probably happening, and, yeah, we probably all are, in a way, contributing, but it's too big a problem, and, you know, I just can't think about that now because I've got my own life to live or an exam to study for or a job to do or whatever it is. People conveniently shut it out when it seems unmanageable or too big or too scary. And I think we need to break that down and just bring it home to people, is that, yeah, that's a very common experience. That's a human way of dealing with things. But another human way of dealing with things is by keeping it out there, keeping it in the public discourse, and making sure that how you live is consistent with those values and that understanding.
I also wonder what you have to say about guilt in relation to this issue, because as just from my personal experience, trying to make all of these individual behavior changes can sometimes make me feel constantly guilty and kind of neurotic about my behavior, because once you start becoming aware of these issues, it's in everything that you do, and it can be kind of difficult to try to do the right thing all the time when often there's not a good choice.
Yeah, no, that's absolutely right. And I think this comes back to another, you know, aspect of human nature, really, that in terms of motivating any kind of behavior, but in this case, motivating responsible, socially useful behavior, like living well and doing what you can to look after the planet, that there's a optimal level of concern or motivation. And if you have too little or too much, you tend to either not bother, paralyzed with anxiety or guilt. So really, we want to help people calibrate to that happy middle ground where they're concerned but not paralyzed. You want people to understand that, hey, you know, we're all in this, and different people have different thresholds for behaving well and responsibly. And I think what we need to do is allow for a lot of individual, you know, difference in that respect, and encourage people to find, if you like, their sweet spot where they are engaged and motivated, but not subject to too much in the way of guilt or paralysis.
That was The Green Desk on 95 BFM. Tihe Modi Ora.
That was indeed The Green Desk, and I will just say that I have said this on air before, but I don't think you were here for it, but Ella won at our little news team awards at the end of the year. She won Most Pissed Off About Climate Change.
Oh my God, so. I didn't even know that.
Well,
that
I'm just saying,
the only award I ever want to get.
Good one to win. So I'm just saying we should all listen to her. But now, a while back for Wairawari Week, we focused on cultural appropriation. And I spoke to Daniel Hernandez of the Auckland University Anthropology Department. His research has centered around kava, a plant that has played a very important role in many different rituals across the Pacific for centuries. The modernization and monetization of it raises some tricky questions about mana and ownership. So Daniel shared his thoughts with us.
Kava is a plant that you drink the roots, and it's found in the tropic regions across Oceania, or the Moana. You know, it's found in Papua, it's found in Pompeii, it's found in Hawaii, it's found in, you know, Samoa, Fiji, Tonga, and elsewhere. So it's kind of all over the place. It's been drunk for several thousand years now, across the Pacific. It's believed to have originated in Vanuatu, where there's over 100 different types of kava. And so that's something to keep in mind as well, is there's all these different varieties, and they have varying levels of strength or effect that they can have. But generally when you drink it, it's it's like a mild sedative, or has kind of like a very mild anesthetic feel to it. It relaxes your muscles, has anti-anxiety properties. You might feel a little bit of numbing in your tongue or your throat initially, but then that goes away. But it's very mild in comparison to a lot of other things. And so usually when people have never tried kava before and they come, they're like, oh, I don't feel anything, right? Because it's not alcohol, it's not marijuana, it's not coffee, it's not any of these other substances. It's very mild in comparison.
Right.
Now, if you drink more, and if you drink a strong variety for several hours, then you're going to have more of effects. But it's not a mind-altering substance either.
Sort of more like physiologically medicinal in a way.
Yeah, yeah. And so I do a little bit of research around music, and there's a Utah reggae group called Natural Roots, and they have a song about kava. And one of their lines is, you know, when they're drinking kava, they say, I feel irie from my head to my toes, but my mind is so clear.
Wow. Right?
So I think those lyrics kind of reflect the experience of kava in that sense.
Kava clarity.
Yeah, yeah. And it's because it removes that stress, right? It has anti-anxiety properties. It relaxes your muscles. But the biggest part of the medicine, I would say, is the mana, right? So from an indigenous perspective, kava is mana. It has a potency. It has a sense of authority. It can be the embodiment of ancestors. It's what's called, Dr. Kaili refers to it as a metonymical heliaki, which is heliaki is like a poetic metaphor in Tongan. And so kava represents the land. It's a metonym of land, right? So it's like a consumption of the land. And so there is, you know, all these other elements to it as well.
Yeah, it's sort of like a connecting force in that way. You ingest it, you're connected to your land.
Absolutely.
Mm. Perhaps it's not so explicitly positive or negative, but do you think that the movement of it into the modern world has been positive, or has it sort of ruined the mana that we were talking about before?
That's a good question. I mean, it's one that's debated, right?
So
with the short amount of time, I won't answer it, but I'll just complicate it.
Yeah.
It can be a variety of things, right? So for people in diaspora, let's say, you know, the commodification of kava, you know, traditionally it was you drink the roots fresh, right? It's a plant, it's kind of more, but that doesn't preserve overseas. And so nowadays, you know, it's dried and pounded, and that makes it easy to export. And so communities overseas can access it. So on one hand, that could be seen as a positive to maintain connections. But on the other hand, this growing interest with kava, in what I guess what I'd call the hipster consumer market, can be negative in the competition for something that is, you know, for the most part, stayed within the communities and is shared through community relations. Like in my case and in others, you know, Pacific Islanders expand. They have, you know, all these relationships globally, and they bring people into their practices.
Mm.
But once we put it into, let's say, the machine, if you will, of the global economy, then that power or autonomy is being removed or challenged out of the communities deciding who and how they share it and how they do that, and then kind of disconnecting it from that and saying, okay, now we're going to put a standardized price and value that isn't yours. It's not a value of manna, it's a value of dollars. And so that can be challenging. I mean, since I've been doing this research for 3.5 years now, and since I began, the prices in kava have tripled.
Wow.
And the quality is now another thing, right? So with the global commodification, you have the creation of so-called high-quality kava, which really is what people were drinking always.
Right.
But with the creation of high quality is the creation of low quality. And people, you know, putting stuff that wasn't traditionally there or drinking stuff that wasn't usually drunk in higher quantities or even cases of people putting in sawdust or different things to pad it out, right? So that's the thing that's always overlooked, is when you create high quality product, you're also creating low quality product. And before that, it was...
Supposed to happen.
It was all manna, right?
Yeah.
It was all kava. And so, and if it's going up in price, and if you're in the working class and diaspora, then that makes it difficult to access not only a cultural tradition, but for many people, what can be a deeply spiritual practice or part of the indigenous metaphysics. Because again, you're bringing the land with you, you're transporting it, you're consuming your land, you're in a sense embodying your ancestors in that process.
Irirangi Poho, Radio Bosom.
The Wire.
And the rest of Daniel's interview is available online at 95BFM/Bcasts. Ko te wai, tēnei marunga BFM. Will be right back after these messages.
The beauty of the fleeting and the ephemeral is so 20th century. BFM's best shows, features and interviews are now available as podcasts on RSS and Apple, yours to cherish forever.
Welcome to 95BFM Top 10. Yours, Pearl.
Fashion. Turn to the left.
On Land of the Woodwood. Got lined up 3 songs.
Yo, 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 welcome back. It's True School.
The Wire.
I don't know.
Well, you're kind of a mellow beginning to the journey.
Welcome to the Saturday 2 to 4. My name is Sarah. I will be...
Greetings and welcome. This is the Rhythm Selection and it's just gone.
Never miss out again. Bcasts. Available now on Apple Podcasts or RSS for whatever podcatcher you're into.
Rudy's delivery.
Oh my goodness. For me?
You're Johnny? Delivery for Johnny, says here. What do you want this?
I mean, yeah, I didn't expect that. It's so beautiful, this beer, for me.
Yes, yeah. What do you want it?
It's a very emotional, overwhelming moment. Thank you so much.
Give the gift of a cold one with a delivery of Rudy's Beer. Delivering directly from Rudy's Brewery in the heart of Auckland, chilled service to central Auckland and free delivery to wider Auckland. Rudy's, brewers of beer. Text Lager to 9090 to send some cold ones to a loved one.
Well, my name is Chris, and I'm here to say, looking for a flatmate in the Lynn that's grey. You gotta be cool, and you gotta be tough. You gotta be a vegan, and no pets or smokers.
Room in Freeman's Bay Cottage. Me, urban sophisticate, wine expert, French cinema aficionado. You, educated, tidy, silent.
Room in flat, Mount Eden. Text Dave.
Whoever or wherever you're after, the 95BFM Accommodation Guide is here for you. Email your listing to accommodationguide@95bfm.com. The 95BFM Accommodation Guide, every Thursday on drive and online at 95bfm.com.
Irirangi Poho, Radio Bosom.
The Wire.
Welcome back to The Wire. What's up? International news time.
Yep, Thailand will be having democratic elections for the first time in 4 years next February after a military coup in 2014. But this is only a mere footnote of the political battles between different political factions and the military in Bangkok since the 2000s. Most of these divisions originated from one man who is now living in Dubai, Thaksin Shinawat. This is Thaksin Shinawat, who was the Prime Minister of Thailand between 2001 and 2006. He founded the AIS, Thailand's current largest mobile operator, in 1987, and that made him one of the richest people in Thailand. His policies mainly targeted the majority rural Thais by giving farmers more interest-free loans and more infrastructure, including Bangkok's new Suvarnabhumi Airport. As a result of his populist policies, Thaksin was very popular in the rural areas and the Thai Rak Thai Party increased its majority in the elections of 2005. But in January the following year, just days after Bangkok implemented a new law raising the limit of foreign ownership in Thai telecom companies from 25 to 49%, Thaksin's family sold their 49% stake in AIS to Temasek, a holding company owned by the Singapore government. The family earned 73 billion baht, or 1.9 billion US dollars from the deal, and they do not have to pay any tax under Thai tax laws. Groups such as the People's Alliance for Democracy, or PAD, were formed to lead protests against Thaksin, and they are known for dressing in yellow, the color of the Thai monarchy, since the movement claims they are defending it from the alleged disloyalty from Thaksin. In response, Thaksin's supporters from the lower classes held rallies to support him in Bangkok, and they were dressed in red. Amid the protests, Thaksin called an election in April, which the opposition boycotted, and the Thai Rak Thai again won a majority of parliament with 460 out of 500 seats. King Bhumibol later nullified the results and another election was scheduled in October. But in the night of September 19th, the Thai army, led by General Prem Tinasulanon, staged a coup in Bangkok and overthrew Thaksin's government, saying the government's alleged corruption and creation of social divisions were the reasons of the coup. The military government then cancelled the upcoming October election, nullified the constitution, dissolved parliament and the constitutional court, and declared martial law. Thaksin, who was in New York that time attending the UN General Assembly, went into self-exile in Britain, and the Thai Rak Thai Party was dissolved. Thaksin's shadow still loomed over Thai politics over the next decade. Remnants of the Thai Rak Thai Party rebranded itself as the People's Power Party, or PPP, and won the military-organized election in December 2007 under the leadership of Samak Senthorowit. But his government did not last long. Immediately after the election, Samak was accused by the People's Alliance for Democracy for being a proxy for Thaksin, which he denied heavily.
Did Mr. Thaksin choose your cabinet for you?
No. No, they just keep a helping hand. We have 37 committee to run this party. He must give some advice, some idea. But the final will be picked up to me.
Anti-Samak protests broke out in March 2008 and escalated in August as protesters occupied several government buildings and disrupted transport services. Samak later was removed from office by the Thai Constitutional Court in September for violating the constitution, as he had hosted and received payment for two cooking TV shows for a few months after being Prime Minister. Samak's deputy, Somchai Wongsawat, who is also Thaksin's brother-in-law, succeeded as Prime Minister. But just 3 months later in December, Somchai was found guilty of corruption and was thrown out. The People's Power Party was also dissolved. Opposition leader Apisit Vichachiwa became Prime Minister after his Democratic Party formed a coalition with several former People's Power Party MPs.
I know that for the past 2 to 3 years, the pictures and the images that you've seen of Thailand have not been positive. But I also know that there are people all over the world who know Thailand better.
However, under his leadership, unemployment increased by 63%. This sparked protest against Apisit in mid-2010, which the military cracked down in May, causing 87 deaths and at least 2,000 injuries. Apisit was defeated in the general election in 2011 against Yingluck Shinawat, Thaksin's younger sister.
I will say that some group of the people might not accept us, but please ask for the many of the group of the people, because the majority, some also support us, because I think we also doing all the policy and run the countries.
Like her predecessors, Yingluck's premiership was marred with allegations that Yingluck was trying to use her position to pardon Thaksin to allow him to return to Thailand, as well as corruption within the rice subsidy schemes, which is her biggest policy promise.
The rice subsidy scheme, introduced by Ms. Yingluck after the last election in 2011, pledged to pay farmers well above market rates for their crops. But the scheme has proved a huge drain on the country's finances, especially with international rice prices falling away. Official figures put the cost of the scheme at about $4 billion a year.
At the end of 2013, protests started against Yingluck, which she responded by dissolving parliament and calling an election for February 2014. However, the results were never certified by the courts as the protests disrupted the voting process. On May 22nd, General Prayut Chan-o-cha from the army launched a coup against the civilian government and arresting government ministers, including Yingluck, who was later released and fled Bangkok. King Phumipol then formally appointed Prayut as the prime minister 4 days later. Prayut then rewrote the constitution, giving the military significant political power. But there's another factor at play in this election, whether the monarchy can still provide stability within political tensions. The monarchy itself is highly respected in Thailand, and under Thai law, it is illegal to defame or insult any member of the royal family. The late King Phumipol, whose reign lasted 7 decades until his death in 2016, enjoyed huge popularity and played a crucial role into resolving different political tensions since the 1970s. However, his successor and son, King Mahawachilalongkorn, does not have the popularity of his father, as his lavish playboy lifestyle while he was heir apparent proved to be controversial in Thailand. Even though he enjoys the prestige and respect that his father left him, it is unclear if he can have the skills to mediate between different political factions to ease tensions within Thailand's volatile politics, like his father did for the past decade, especially after the coming election next year. Yes, so Prayut has not said whether he will run in the election, but the Democrats led by Aphisit, who is also the former Prime Minister of Thailand, will aim to re-enter government despite the military now have a strong support according to various polls. So you can hear the full report of it at 95bfm.com/bcast. But now, as you have heard in the intro, this is Mary Margaret's final wire for the next couple of months because she's off to London. And
are we not playing a supplementary clip?
And we have a little farewell gift for her.
What? Are you guys serious? Oh my God, okay.
Right. Hi, Mary Margaret.
Hello, Mary Margaret.
Hi, Mary Margaret.
Ben, come and fucking close to the mic.
Care that.
It's me, Ben, and Angus here.
Hello.
And you're obviously off to better and brighter, colder things in England very soon. We're going to miss you terribly, aren't we?
We will.
Yep, I remember when you were... Actually, I think it was probably one of my first wires, and you were producing, and look at you now. Just bloody, you know, you've been hosting, been remarkable.
Makes me look like shit.
Well, it really does make you look
not
like
hard.
Shit. Yeah. We... Yeah, I mean, well, the newsroom will just be less banterous,
less exciting,
less insightful, and less roasting of Ben. And yeah, I think we're all really going to miss you. Ben, you want to say a few words?
I already said a few words.
Oh, for fuck's
more
sake.
More than a few.
Sorry.
Hi, Mary Margaret.
Yeah, Angus?
Yeah. I said everything
all
I can.
The best.
All the best, yeah.
Don't go joining some fucking student radio in London. Jesus. They'll probably suck.
All that, yeah.
And they'll probably sound like BBC wankers. But yes, we love you.
You're laughing. You don't sound like a BBC wanker at all.
Fuck off, Ben.
Mary Margaret, I've written something down in honour of how incredibly organised you are as a wire host. It has been an absolute pleasure being your news director. You are an outstanding person with a keen mind to challenge and question, while also being open to learning new things yourself. I have loved watching you grow in your time at B and seeing you take the next step with some trepidation before nailing whatever it is you try and do. I wish you all the very best on your next adventure. Do not stop being you.
Hey, Mary Margaret. Thanks for being an absolute legend. Hands down the best dancer out of all the wire hosts. All the best on your next endeavours and we'll see you around. Beautiful.
Mary Margaret, I can't believe it's your final wire. I remember the first time you walked in, all bubbly and fun and happy, and you ran in and you were so keen to be a journalist and say the news and also just get really involved in the community at BFM and get to know everybody. And it's been such an awesome journey getting to know you and having you as part of the B family. And it'll be really sad to see you go, but it's been awesome to see how much you've grown and been challenged in this environment. So good luck for the future, girl. You got it.
Mary Margaret, you're a good dancer. You're going to London and I will miss you. Hope you liked my song. Love your work, girl. You will be truly missed around the BFM studio. I can't wait till you get back. When are you getting back? Should make it soon. Yeah,
You're an angel.
I am so incredibly proud of how far you've come in your time being at BFM. I remember when you first started and we were having chats about gender and politics and thinking you were just this incredibly smart, well-rounded, funny, beautiful girl. You've basically budded into this incredible journalist. At the end of the day, it doesn't matter where in the world you are always going to be a part of the BFM family. I miss you already. Come home soon.
That was The Wire.
I'm going to be freaking out on air now. I can't believe... Look, okay, I'm just going to give you an insight, all you listeners at home, to the BFM system. We always plug in our audio, and Justin called his Thailand story the same one and then said supplementary, so I really had no idea that was going to happen, and I'm extremely chuffed. That's the loveliest thing that's ever happened. So thank you guys so much. But that was indeed our final Tuesday Wire for 2018. Thank you to everyone for tuning in all year. We had so much fun, and thank you to my awesome producers. And also a really big thank you to our amazing news director, Lillian Hanley, who works around the clock and is just like one of the most inspiring people I've ever met. So pucky pucky for her. I'm going to leave you with some Santa Gold, who's a fave of mine. This song is called Fame. And I miss you all very much, and I hope you stay safe and maybe a little bit happy over Christmas. And you'll hear from me again when my hiatus is over. Ka kite.
That was a 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95BFM.com/bcasts.